Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It's February 9th. Tonight is Tu Bishvat. And in Parsha Shlach, we're on page 816. Top of the page. Pasuk Lamed Beis, verse 32. The Jews were in the wilderness. And they found a man, Mikoshesh Eitzim Biyom HaShabbos. He was being Mikoshesh wood on the day of Shabbos. Now, in the translation here, they translate it as gathering wood. We will discuss this momentarily, that word Mikoshesh actually has a debate what the intent is. At any rate, he was doing something he should not have been doing on Shabbos. Vayakrivu oso hamotzim oso mikoshesh eitzim, and they brought him forth, those who found him being mikoshesh wood, el Moshe ve'el Aaron ve'el kol ha'edah, to Moshe and to Aaron and to the entire congregation. Vayanichu oso bamishmar, and they placed him under guard. Kilo forash ma ye aselo, because they did not. It was not clear. Had not been clarified what should be done to him. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe. So Hashem said to Moshe, "Mos yumas ha'ish, the man shall die. Ragomo sova avanim kol ha'ida, the entire congregation shall stone him with stones. Michutz la'machane, outside the camp. Vayotziu so kol ha'ida, the entire nation took him out. El michutz la'machane, to outside the camp." Vayirgimu oso bo'avonim vayamos, and they stoned him with stones, and he died. Kasher tzivah Hashem es Moshe, as Hashem commanded Moshe. Pretty sad story. Somebody was mechalel Shabbos, so he desecrated the Shabbos, and therefore he was put to death. And the method of execution was stoning. So there's several things to discuss over here. First of all, let's talk about what does the word mikoshesh mean. So the reason why they translate it here as to gather is because if you'll hold the place here and look back in Parsha Shmos, which actually wasn't so long ago, only a few weeks ago on Shabbos. So at the end of Parsha Shmos, Moshe Rabbeinu comes to Paro for the first time and demands that he let the Jews go. And Paro, as you know, reacts by making things worse. And what he does is he takes away the straw. So if you look on page 314, Pasuk Zion, verse 7. So this is what Paro commanded. Lo so sifun la seis tevin la'am lilbon halevenim. You shall not continue to give straw to the nation to make the bricks. Kismol shil shom, like was done yesterday and the day before. Heim yolchu, they'll go. Vikoshishu lahem tevin. That's that same verb. And they will be koshesh, straw. So, straw, there are two types of straw in the field. When you harvest grain, let's take wheat as our example. When you harvest wheat, the way you do it is, you take a sickle and you cut the wheat, and when you do that, the wheat is a very large stalk. That's what it is. It's a very long stalk, but the kernels of wheat are at the very top. So what you do is you cut the wheat, let's say roughly halfway down. I'm not a farmer, so I'm just making up that number. But somewhere on the length of that stalk, you cut it. You don't want to cut it too close to the wheat because you want something to hold on to as you bring as you deal with. We'll talk about what you do in a minute. But as you deal with the wheat, you want something to hold on to bring it in to deal with it. On the other hand, you don't want it too long because then it gets unwieldy. So let's say half the stalk remains attached to the ground. The other half has the wheat on it. And then after you harvest it, so you cut it, then you bundle it, and then you take it to be threshed. You take it to the threshing floor. Threshing floor is just a large area with a hard surface, and you bang the wheat in order to detach the kernel from its chaff, from whatever's holding it, from its immediate container, peel or shell. So you bang it. Now you can bang it either by smashing on the ground or by hitting it with sticks or whatever it is. Then they winnow it, then they throw it up in the air, and the wind blows away the lighter part and leaves the heavier part where it is. You don't need a heavy wind for this. Just a light breeze will do it. So when you throw it up in the air, what happens is that the wheat kernels, which are the heavy part, do not get blown by the wind. They fall back down onto the threshing floor. Meanwhile, the straw, meaning the long stalk, gets blown away by the wind. It gets scattered. So then it just gets scattered all over the place. It becomes fertilizer. It just gets scattered into the field. So you end up with two parts of straw. You have the straw that was still attached to the ground after you harvested the grain, and then you have the other half of the straw, the top half of the stalk of wheat, which gets blown away by the breeze in the winnowing process. So those are the two parts of straw. Simply, when the Jews were gathering straw for bricks, they were gathering that which had already been cut from the ground. It was no longer attached to the ground. It was the top half of the straw that was blown all over the place because of the winnowing process, and that you went and collected. Now, in theory, if they ran out of that, then there was still other straw which was attached to the ground, which is the other half, which is still there from after the harvesting, which is still attached to the ground. So this word, v'kosheshu lahem tevin, and they were koshesh straw. Again, here they translate it as gathering, because that's probably what it was. But it may have also been detaching, cutting from the ground, because there would still be some straw attached to the ground. Later on, the same verb is used in Pasuk Yud Beis, verse 12, same page. Vayafetz ha'am b'chol eretz Mitzrayim, the entire nation spread out in all of the land of Egypt, l'kosheish kash latevin, to gather straw for straw. That word kash is the noun to gather that which is gathered for straw. That's a very typical Hebrew thing, that you have the same root for the noun and for the verb. The reason why straw is sometimes called kash is because the verb, the way you get the straw, is called mikoshesh or lekashesh. So you end up with this word kash and mikoshesh. So here, the word lekoshesh would either mean to gather, or it would mean to harvest, to cut, to literally cut it from the ground. Lower down, of course, than the original cut would be. This time very close to the ground in order to get the straw. In the language of the Mishnah sometimes uses the word kash and sometimes uses the word tevin for straw. Tosus explains that kash and tevin are these two ends of, it's the same thing, it's the same stalk of wheat, but one of them refers to the half that remains in the ground when you harvest the wheat. The other word refers to the half that comes out of the, that is detached when you harvest the wheat. But they both refer to the same growth, the same long stalk. One is called kash, one is called tevin. There's actually a difference of opinion, which is which. At any rate, in translating, we can go back to our page now on page 764. Where am I?
817.
817, I'm sorry, I lost my place. 817, thank you. 816. So in translating this word mikoshesh, that this person violated Shabbos by being mikoshesh, the question is, what did he do? He certainly was gathering wood. But which melacha, which one of the lamed tes melachos, which one of the 39 melachos of Shabbos did he do? And there are three opinions. One is that he did kotzer. Kotzer is to cut from the ground. If a person pulls an apple off of a tree on Shabbos, that's called kotzer. That's detaching something growing from the ground. Cutting or harvesting wheat or anything that grows from the ground is called kotzer. So one opinion is that he cut the wood from the trees or whatever he was gathering on Shabbos. He cut this wood from the ground, from the where it was growing. That would be kotzer. That's one possibility. If it was already detached and he only gathered it, so which of the lamed tes malachos, which of the 39 malachos would he violate by gathering wood? Well, there are two possibilities. One is me'amer. Me'amer means to bundle. One is not allowed to bundle the harvest that has already been harvested, meaning it's already been cut from the ground, and now it's lying in the field, and now you bundle it in the place where it grew. You bundle it up to take it someplace else. That's called me'amer, and that would be a malacha of Shabbos as well. We're not so familiar with the malacha of me'amer because it rarely has application for us. Since we're not in an agricultural society, we rarely come across me'amer. Some of the malachos that are for agriculture carry over easily to our homes, like borer. Borer, which is to separate, we know we deal with that almost every Shabbos, even though the original intent of the borer is to separate the wheat kernels from the little pebbles that were not blown away by the wind. That would be borer. But the carryover to our house is a common thing on Shabbos. There's all kinds of borer issues. But me'amer, which means to gather produce or something like that, in the place where it grew, after it has been detached from the ground, that's not such a common thing. In theory, if someone had an apple tree in their backyard, and the apples had fallen off the tree, either before Shabbos or on Shabbos, and then on Shabbos a person goes out and gathers up those apples into a basket, in theory that might be me'amer, depending on how it's done. Because it's where it grew. Now again, even a person who has an apple tree in their backyard rarely would do that on Shabbos. First of all, if it was attached to the tree when Shabbos began, then those apples are muktzah. If they fall off the tree on Shabbos, those apples are muktzah until after Shabbos. Of course, one would not pick it off the tree on Shabbos. And if it fell off the tree before Shabbos, it probably already gathered it up. So it's still an unusual thing for us to come in contact with this malacha of me'amer, but it is a malacha. And if he did this, if he gathered up the wood that had already fallen off the tree, but he gathered it into bundles on Shabbos, that would be one of the lamed tes malachos called me'amer, to bundle. So that's the second possibility. And the third possibility is that he carried, that there was no eruv, and he picked up the wood and carried it in a Rishus HaRabim, in a public domain, or from a Rishus HaRabim into a Rishus HaYachid, from a public domain into a private domain. And that would also be one of the Lama Tes Malachos. So the three opinions are, either he did kotzer, detaching from the ground, or he did ma'amer, bundling, or he did mavir, carrying in Rishus HaRabim, carrying something outside of an Eruv. Yeah.
When did the rules change that violating some of these rules on Shabbos that people don't have to be put to death nowadays?
Who says they changed? Okay, we'll talk about putting to death. We'll talk about that. We have to talk about capital punishment anyway. Because it's not so easy. It's not so easy for a person to actually deserve capital punishment. A person really has to try hard to get capital punishment.
Rabbi Pransky, when you say me'amer, is that with an aleph?
With an ayin. With an ayin.
So is that me'amer?
Yeah, same word. Yeah.
Is it connected also?
Probably. I don't know how, but probably it is. Yeah.
What was the configuration of the Jews at this point? Did they have the clouds and the fire?
They had that, yeah.
So that wasn't considered an Eruv?
No.
That's because it was around them?
No. No. Yeah.
It doesn't say that he was warmed.
Okay, good. So you're bringing up how could he be put to death? We're going to talk about that. Okay, good. But that's the first issue, which is what did he do? Just simply translating the word, they translate it as gather, but gather really could have different implications, and there's the Gemara has three opinions about what he did. But he definitely did one of the Lamathas Malachos.
So it doesn't really matter anyway which one, right? Because they're all the same punishment?
They're all the same punishment, yeah.
So
yeah. In the Gemara, there's a technical discussion that ensues from it, but yeah, it, for our purposes, it doesn't matter. Right.
So
yeah.
Doesn't Amir, like, how Borer transfers? Can you, like, gather? Is it only fruit?
It doesn't usually carry over because in order to be Ma'amer, it has to, first of all, something that grows from the ground, and it has to be in the place where it grew.
Pine straw?
I guess
the big thing, like you're around sukkah's time and you're up around your sukkah, and why would you not want to sweep that?
Right, but you're not gathering; you're getting rid of it. Now it's muktzah, so but you might either you get.
You're allowed, right? We can sweep muktzah, no?
It depends what kind of muktzah. That's real muktzah. That's not just that depends. It depends on the kind of muktzah. But anyway, but you're not gathering over there; you're getting rid of it. Gathering would be to to bundle
you
up.
Want it.
Yeah. So it's very rare to come up with it today. There actually is a discussion of me'amer. We don't deal with this today, but the Gemara discusses the way that they used to harvest salt was that you dug shallow ditches at the high tide mark or below the high tide mark at near the ocean, and the during high tide the ocean would come in, and then low tide would go out, leaving these pools of salt water, and it would evaporate, and then you left with the salt. And then you gather that salt. So there's a discussion whether that's called me'amer, because that's where it grows, so to speak. Right? So the issue over there would be maybe it is a dirabanan of me'amer. But I'm just trying to show you an application that goes beyond, a tree growing in your backyard. But for us, it almost never happens. It's a very rare thing to happen today.
So it doesn't relate only to something that grows from the ground?
Well, that would be a dirabanan.
That's from the ground and other things. Everything else.
Yeah, right. Okay, so at any rate, this is the possibility of the three different malachos he may have done, and you see the relationship with this verb, mikoshesh, and what we have in Parshas Shmos. So he did it on Shabbos, and he was discovered. They found him doing this. So then it says that they brought him, those who found him, brought him to Moshe and to Aaron, and to the entire Eidah, and they put him under guard because it had not been explained to them what should be done with him. So let us take a look at what exactly had already been explained and what had not been explained. We already had the mitzvah of keeping Shabbos. Where is the mitzvah of keeping Shabbos introduced in which parsha? Here's a hint. We read it yesterday. It's in Parshas B'Shalach. In Parshas B'Shalach with the man, so that's where the mitzvah of Shabbos is introduced. However, the punishment for violating Shabbos is not mentioned in Parshas B'Shalach. It says Hashem told the Jews not to go look for the man on Shabbos. They did anyway, some of them did anyway. But it doesn't talk about what the punishment is for violating Shabbos. Where is the punishment for violating Shabbos spelled out? Now it's in a couple places, but we're going to look in Parshas Ki Sisa. In Parshas Kisisa, before the Aveira of the Egel Hazav, of the golden calf, the Torah discusses Shabbos. Now the reason why Shabbos is brought up in Parshas Kisisa is because Shabbos is directly related to the building of the Mishkan. The building of the Mishkan is discussed in all the parashas at the end of Sefer Shmos. We're coming up to them very shortly. Truma, Tetzaveh, Kisisa, Vayakel, Pekudei, all discussing the building of the Mishkan. Of course, Shabbos is mentioned in the Aseres HaDibros, which is coming up in this coming week's parasha, Parshas Yisrael. But the punishment is mentioned in Parshas Kisisa. And here, if you look on page 490, the last paragraph, the bottom paragraph on the page. The paragraph starts with Pasuk Yud Beis, verse 12. So, first Hashem commands about Shabbos. Let's look at Yud Dalet 14. Ushmartem es haShabbos, you shall guard the Shabbos. Ki kodesh hi lachem, for it is sanctified to you. Michaleleha mos, you must. Those who desecrate it shall be put to death. Ki chol ha'oseh v'melacha, for anybody who does work on Shabbos, v'nechresa ha'nefesh ha'him ekerav ha'meha, that soul shall be cut off from its nation. So the Torah here spells out two different punishments for violating Shabbos. One is capital punishment, to be put to death. The other is kares, is being cut off. So the Gemara explains that this is referring to two different circumstances. Both are referring to violating Shabbos on purpose. On purpose means the person knows that it is prohibited and does it anyway. On purpose doesn't mean a person who doesn't realize what they're doing, a person doesn't realize that it is prohibited, doesn't understand the severity of it, all that is not, there's no capital punishment for that. That's all in the realm of shogeg. Shogeg, which is a careless sin, shogeg would be a person who knows that it's wrong, but doesn't fully grasp that it's wrong, or thinks, well, maybe, you know, that kind of thing. They're not fully clear about what's happening. But someone who is fully clear about what's happening, does it on purpose anyway, that is mazid, that is doing the avera on purpose, premeditatedly. So, for doing it on purpose, there are two punishments spelled out. One is capital punishment, one is kares, one is being cut off. So kares is not administered by us. We only administer capital punishment, meaning the beis din, the court. The court doesn't administer kares. Kares is a punishment from Hashem. So when does one receive one or the other? If there was warning and witnesses are edim, warning is hasra'a, if there were witnesses and warning, then the person would be put to death. But if there was either no warning or no witnesses, and the person knew what they were doing and did it on purpose anyway, how would we know that? We wouldn't. But Hashem would know. Then the punishment is kares. Now, kares is a bad punishment. However, as with any punishment that is meted out by Hashem rather than by us, there is the chance to do teshuvah and not get punished. Because Beis Din cannot allow for that. If a person does something for which they are punishable in court, the court system cannot be mitigated by a person doing teshuvah. Even though we tell a person you need to do teshuvah, but we can't not punish them if they do teshuvah, because that would render the entire court system meaningless. We would never be able to carry out anything. There's got to be a system in court. A system in court can't be based on what's going on in a person's head. It's got to be based on what the person does. So, if there's warning and there are witnesses, a person's put to death. If either there was no warning or no witnesses, but it was done on purpose, fully understanding what it was, then there is kares, which is administered by Hashem, and a person could do teshuvah, and the punishment would never happen if the person does a proper teshuvah. So here we have a clear commandment to put him to death if there are witnesses and if there was warning. Now, back on our page, on page 816, there were definitely witnesses. It says they found him. There were definitely witnesses. However, was there warning? It doesn't say whether there was warning or not. Says the Gemara, there was warning. How do we know there was warning? Because they put him to death. They couldn't put him to death if there wasn't warning. Therefore, there must have been warning. And the Medrash fills in the gaps that they said to him, you're not allowed to do this. It is Shabbos. And he said, even though it is Shabbos, I'm doing it anyway. He accepted the warning and continued anyway. That's a very unusual thing. Most of the time, even if a person is doing something wrong on purpose, if he's caught red-handed and he's warned, he will stop. Especially if he's told, if you continue, we are going to take you to court and we're going to put you to death. And a person will normally stop under those circumstances. But if a person continues and says, I don't care, I'm doing it anyway, then they are put to death. This is one of those circumstances where the person was warned, the person said, I understand it, and I'm doing it anyway. and therefore he was put to death. However, before we get into that element of it, the Torah here says that they put him under guard because it had not been explained what to do to him. What do you mean it wasn't explained what to do to him? We know what to do to him. The Torah told us in Parashas Kisisa, put him to death. So what was not made clear? Okay, and the answer is, which form of capital punishment should we use? That had not been made clear yet. It was not stated which form of capital punishment. There are four types of capital punishment that Beis Din uses. We have discussed them already when we talked about capital punishment in the past, but we'll spell them out here as again. The worst type of capital punishment is skila, is stoning. It's not a fun topic to talk about putting people to death, but I just want to explain to you because this is commonly misunderstood. Stoning, the way stoning works, the death is not typically through a stone being thrown at the person. Typically, it is through the fall, because stoning actually is being pushed off of a two-story building onto a stone surface. It's the impact of the body onto the stone surface that is, quote, stoning. That's where they get, usually that's what would kill them. In the event that that would not kill them, then a stone is thrown down on top of them to kill them. It's not a bunch of stones being hurled at a person. That's not what it is. But that's the worst type of capital punishment. Then there's also sreifa. I'm going from worst to least. They're all bad. They're all death. But so the second worst is sreifa. Sreifa is burning. We do not burn people under fire. We have very hot lead that is poured down a person's throat that kills them quickly. That's a second thing. The third type is hereg. Hereg is beheading. And finally, chenek. Chenek is strangulation. Those are the four types of capital punishment. They're all quick deaths, and they're all designed not to mutilate the body. Beheading does sever the body, but it doesn't mutilate the body. They're not the design of the capital punishment specifically is not to mutilate the body. There is a body to be buried after capital punishment is administered. We don't make the body in a way that it's not able to be buried properly. And anyway, those are the four types of capital punishment. For Shabbos, they knew that the punishment was capital punishment, but they didn't know which one of the four should be administered. So they needed to wait to find out. So they put him under guard in order to find out what to do. Now, we had a story earlier in the Chumash of someone else who was put to death. They put to death two different people for capital punishment, for sins that they did in the official execution at the hands of a Beis Din. We had that before with somebody else. Anybody remember what that was? Okay, the Mekalel, the one who cursed God. That was back in Parshas Emor. Then we had the person who was had to do with which where he should pitch his tent, and he was put to death because he cursed. He had a court case. He lost the court case, and then he was megadef. He cursed God. Now over there, it also says they put him under guard. It says that as well, until Hashem tells Moshe Rabbeinu that he is to be put to death. The Gemara explains both these stories happened at the same time, meaning the same time frame. They were both under guard at the same time. The one who cursed God and the one who was Mechalel Shabbos, who desecrated the Shabbos, both were under guard at the same time because in both cases, we didn't know exactly what to do, but there was a difference. They were not held in the same cell. And the reason is because the one who violated Shabbos, we knew, and he knew that he was to be put to death. The only question was, how? The other one, the one who cursed God, it had not yet been explained what to do to him at all. They did not know whether the punishment was capital punishment or perhaps lashes or something else. They didn't know what the punishment was. So they didn't lock them up together because that would have been a form of inoy hadin, of an affliction of justice. That, as I'm about to explain, our court system is designed in a way not to cause undue psychological pain and suffering for these sorts of crimes. Since the one who cursed Hashem, it was unclear whether he needed to be put to death. They didn't lock him up along with the one who violated Shabbos because that would have implied that he's certainly going to be put to death, which would not have been right. Because there was a possibility that he would not have been put to death. In the end, he was put to death because the punishment was capital punishment. But we didn't know that and he didn't know that. So he was locked up separately. The way that capital punishment, the way that we judge a capital crime is that the judges debate back and forth about the crime. And there is a rule called halonas hadin, which means that they begin trying the case during the day, and they attempt to finish up the trying of the case in one day, and then they do not rule on the case until the next morning. The judges need to sleep on it so that they toss and turn about the possibility of actually putting someone to death, that they should have trouble sleeping that night. The Mishnah tells us that the judges needed to, they barely eat that night. They don't eat a regular meal and they talk over the case amongst themselves and they think about what they're about to do, which is about to put somebody to death. The next day, they come back, reconvene. If the vote is still to execute, if that's the case, then we execute the person that day. We don't believe in death row, which is a very cruel, very, very cruel way to treat somebody, to have them sitting, wallowing in a cell with no life whatsoever for years with this thing over their head that they're going to be executed. It's a terrible, terrible thing that we do to people in this country. So that we don't do that. If they are to be executed, they're executed that same day. Immediately they're put to death. Because of inui hadin, because affliction of justice, psychologically, it's a terrible thing to have a person have a death sentence on their head and then not be put to death. So that is the way it works. So the Mekalo, the one who cursed Hashem, since we didn't know whether he'd be executed or not, he was held under guard in a separate cell. Just to show you, I'll get to your question in just one moment, that this is why in the previous paragraph on page 814, which we discussed last week, where we talked about the punishment for Avodah Zara, for worshipping idolatry, there the punishment is also to be put to death. But if you'll recall, in Pasuk Lamed, verse 30, the phrase that the Torah uses is that someone who does this on purpose, Es Hashem Hu Megadef. So this person, they translate that as, this person is, he blasphemed Hashem. By worshipping Avodah Zarah, he blasphemed Hashem. So the Gemara tells us, I mentioned this to you last week, that this is a remez, this is a hint that one who blasphemes Hashem is also put to death with skila, with stoning, just as the one who worships Avodah Zarah. That just when one worships Avodah Zarah, they're stoned, they're put to death. So too a person who curses Hashem is put to death. That's why the Torah uses this phrase. So the Medrash explains the story of the one who was Mechalel Shabbos, the one who desecrated Shabbos, is juxtaposed to this paragraph about Avodah Zarah. And in the paragraph of Avodah Zarah, blaspheming Hashem is also mentioned. And that hints to us that the story of the one who cursed Hashem happened at the same time as this person who violated Shabbos. That's the progression and the way the Torah tips us off that they both happened at the same time. Yes?
So they're in the Midbar. There are no two-story buildings.
That's correct. Well, they would build something if they needed it.
It says, we're going to ba'avanim, no? And that doesn't mean
stones. Yeah, they don't throw stones. Again, they throw them off the thing. The impact usually kills them. If not, then they take a big stone and they throw it down on him. That should kill him. If that doesn't work, then they have to use more stones. But if they usually...
Does Hasra mean that warning and this is the punishment that's going to happen to you?
So it's warning... That person has to know how severe it is. They may not know that it's skila... That it's,
So then how was the person who was Megadev if they didn't know that he was going to...
That's a very good question. So the Gemara asks this question. So that was a Haras Shah. That was an exception to the rule. That's normally, Mrs. Deitch is bringing up that in order for warning to be something that is effective, that would actually trigger the capital punishment, it's not good enough to say that you understand you're not allowed to violate Shabbos. The person says, yes, I do, and he does it anyway. That would not make the person liable for capital punishment. The warning has to be, you understand you're not allowed to violate Shabbos, and if you do, if you continue doing this, you will be put to death. And the person says, I know, and I'm doing it anyway. So Mrs. Deitch is asking that, with the case of the one who cursed Hashem, they didn't know that he was to be put to death, so the warning clearly didn't include that he would be put to death, so how could he be put to death then? So the answer is that was an exception. That one case was an exception to the rule. There he was put to death, even though the warning was inadequate. That is correct. There is a discussion whether the warning actually has to include what type of capital punishment as well. Either way, these two cases, Hashem says explicitly they are to be put to death, and they were put to death for their actions.
Who is this Ish?
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. Okay. Now, so the person was put to death for what he did, and the Jews carried out the law of Hashem. So, who was this person? Who is this Ish? So, there is an opinion in the Gemara that this person was Tzalafchad. As in, Benos Tzalafchad, the daughters of Tzalafchad. Now, we have not been introduced to the daughters of Tzalafchad. Well, the truth is, they were mentioned. They were mentioned, but...
They were not mentioned yet.
But in the count, they weren't mentioned yet. They're going to be mentioned in Parshas Pinchas, but they've not been mentioned yet. So, let us hold the place here and turn to Parshas Pinchas, where the story of the daughters of Tzalafchad comes up. Now, we know that the daughters of Tzalafchad are held up as very, very righteous women. Righteous women and wise women. And they are an example, they're role models for us. So, on page 886, the daughters of Tzalafchad have to explain, why is their father no longer living? Because they're coming to say, we want a portion in the land of Israel. So if their father were alive, their father would have the portion in the land of Israel. They're asking for their father's portion. They're saying, we have no brothers, so we would like the portion that they would, that the, by our brothers would have gotten. Where's your father? So on page 886, Pashut Gimel, verse 3, they say as follows, Avinu meis bamidbar, our father died in the wilderness. V'hu lo hayabisa chayda. He was not amongst the congregation hanoadim al Hashem that complained against Hashem ba'adas Korach, amongst the group of Korach. He wasn't a scoundrel amongst the group of Korach. Ki vechet o meis. He died of his own sin. Uvanim lo hayulo. And he had no sons. So they tell us that he died because of his own sin. So what sin is that? It is not said here what sin it was for which he was put to death, which was his own sin. So there are two opinions. One opinion is that he was from the Mapilim. He was the one of the ones, as we learned earlier in Parshas Shlach, that the group of people that after Moshe Rabbeinu said, that's it, Hashem said, you're going to wander the wilderness for the next 38 years, you're not going into the land. Then we had those Mapilim, those who forced their way, and they went to Eretz Yisrael anyway, even though Moshe Rabbeinu said, it's not going to work, you won't be successful. And they went anyway, and they were killed, all of them, to a man, were all killed trying to get into Eretz Yisrael. So some say Tzalafchad was from the Mapilim, that he was from those people. The opinion of Rabbi Akiva is that he is the Mikoshesh. He's this person who violated Shabbos. That's the opinion of Rabbi Akiva in the Gemara. We know that the daughters of Tzalafchad demonstrate a love for the land of Eretz Yisrael. That we know they are role models for us in the way that they love Eretz Yisrael and they ask for a portion in the land. If their father Tzalafchad was from the Mapilim, even though he did a sin, but at least the sin makes sense in that it does demonstrate an intense desire for the land of Israel. It was a misplaced desire under the circumstances, and he paid for it with his life, but it does show the same midah, the same character trait as his daughters, and it makes a lot of sense. If he was the Mekoshesh, though, if he's our person who violated Shabbos, it is more difficult to know what is the connection between the daughters of Tzalafchad and their father. Here you have these very righteous women, five of them, all of them righteous, all of them wise, and they seem to be, the Torah seems to indicate that they have some relationship with their father. It's not that they were estranged from their father. And yet, their father violated Shabbos. What's the connection between that and the daughters of Tzalafchad? But perhaps the greater question is, irrespective of who this person was, why did he do it? He violated Shabbos. Most of the time, when we come across people who violate Shabbos, the reason they violate Shabbos is because they wanted something. The person wanted to go to work because they wanted money. Person wanted to drive because they wanted to go someplace. Whatever it is, person wanted something, so they violated Shabbos. That's typically why a person violates Shabbos. Here, what was it? Did he desperately need the wood? And more so, what is this that they say to him, stop, if you continue, we're going to take you to court and they're going to put you to death. And he says, Afal Pekain, even so, I'm doing it anyway. So he forfeited his life. What was so important about what he was doing that it was worth forfeiting his life? What did he do over here? And then of course, why is it here in Parshas Shlach? Here we have the story of the Meraglim, of the spies, and then we have the story of the Mekoshesh. Now, no matter what we're going to say about the Mekoshesh, about this person who violated Shabbos, we have to keep in mind that he did a sin, and he did a bad sin. He violated Shabbos. There's no justification we're going to say that's going to turn this person into a tzaddik, into a righteous person. No matter what his rationale was, he did a sin for which he's put to death, which means he did a bad thing. The putting to death of this person may have atoned for him, which means that he may be in Gan Eden right now, but his action was without question wrong. No one can rewrite it to suggest that his action was good. It was bad. Hashem doesn't want people doing averos. But that doesn't mean he didn't have a way of rationalizing what he was doing. So there is an opinion that this person was deliberately violating Shabbos so that he would be put to death. That he wanted to violate Shabbos and wanted to be put to death in order to show the sanctity and how great Shabbos is. That Shabbos is not to be trifled with. This is what happens when a person violates Shabbos. He did it on purpose to be the example for everyone of how significant Shabbos is. Now, at the end of the day, that goal is certainly accomplished. We actually have a real story of someone who was put to death for violating Shabbos. Someone was stoned for violating Shabbos. It actually happened. It does not make his action good. It's bad. He shouldn't have done it. But it would at least give some insight into why he did it. Now, why was that so important to him to show how special Shabbos is, or how important it is to keep Shabbos? The Jews had just committed the sin of the spies. The Jews had left Egypt with a beautiful road ahead of them, a dream. As Moshe Rabbeinu told them, Hashem is going to take you to a land of Zavas, Cholav, Udevash, that flows with milk and honey. This was a journey which was meant to last a relatively short time, and by the time they got to the summertime after they left Egypt, they should have entered Eretz Yisrael. Unfortunately, we got derailed with the sin of the golden calf. But the next summer, we were now ready to enter Eretz Yisrael, and it should have happened. But now we got derailed with the sin of the spies. With that, this generation is told, that's it, you're not going in. It's going to be your children who will enter the land, but basically, you are stuck in the wilderness. A people that has had a goal, that has had a dream, that they then do something for which that dream, that goal, is shattered, and now they are to wander, do they matter anymore? Does it make a difference how they behave?
Suicide. Yeah.
Is this no different than death row? Your life basically is meaningless. You're just going to hang around until you die, because we don't really need you or care about you. We just want your children. But you're meaningless.
Plus he had no son.
Well, he had no sense, right. We'll get to that. That's a very good point. Right? So you are essentially meaningless. This generation, you're just a filler. You're just taking up space. It would be best if you all died today. So we have to wait for everybody to grow up, that's all. So you're just taking up space. That is a very easy message for a person to get if they are one of the Dor HaMidbar, this generation that was supposed to be this special generation that receives the Torah and enters Eretz Yisrael, and now we're just waiting around for them to die. That's a pretty lousy existence. Number one. So Lavchad, as was just mentioned, even more than everybody else, has more of a reason to feel that way. Because Salafchad had no sons. And at this point, the Jews have not yet been told that if there are no sons, then the daughters inherit. At this point, the default would be, if there are no sons, then whatever land the father would have had goes off into his family, meaning his extended family. It goes to his brothers or his cousins or whatever it is, but not to his offspring. So everybody else, at least they are involved in a significant task of raising the next generation of sons who will inherit the land. But Salafchad had no sons to raise. Not only is he not getting Eretz Yisrael, neither are his children, he thinks. Or at least everybody thinks at that point. Therefore, Salafchad represents more than anybody else this meaningless existence. You're just around until you die, and then we'll move on to the next generation. But Salafchad knows that this is not true. Salafchad knows that in reality, even a nation that can't enter Eretz Yisrael can still serve Hashem, perform mitzvos, and bring the world towards its completion, towards its fruition. It may not be that they could bring the world all the way to its fruition because they can't go into Eretz Yisrael, but they can certainly help move the world towards where it needs to be. Just as we are in Galus, we are in exile, all the generations that came before us in exile, they did not succeed in bringing Mashiach and moving on to the next stage of where this world is supposed to go. Were their lives meaningless? Of course not. Their lives were very valuable as they too served Hashem and moved the world closer to where it needs to be. Tzolof'chad understood this, but Tzolof'chad could have represented for everybody what they might have been thinking about the meaninglessness of their existence. Therefore, Tzolof'chad wanted to show in the most powerful way possible that their lives matter. How do you show that their lives matter? Because he did a sin which they all knew the punishment was capital punishment. If one's life doesn't matter, then their actions don't matter. And then why put them to death for violating Shabbos? If it makes no difference, if your life is meaningless, why should we put a person to death for violating Shabbos? After all, it doesn't matter what they do. Hashem doesn't care what they do. The person is meaningless. If we put a person to death for what they did, that means what they did mattered. And it makes a difference whether they keep Shabbos or, God forbid, don't keep Shabbos. And the Mekoshesh Tzolof'chad, if he is Tzolof'chad, but the Mekoshesh wanted to show the Jews, we matter, we are important, and I'm going to show this to you because I'm going to do that which everybody knows you can't do. Look what's going to happen to me. They're not going to shrug their shoulders and ignore me. They're going to put me to death. And in so doing, he showed that they matter despite the fact that they cannot get into the land of Israel. They cannot move the world completely to where it needs to be, but they still matter and their lives are important. And what they do, Hashem cares about. And therefore, he is put to death. In a certain way, this does reflect his daughters, or his daughters do reflect him. Because his daughters, what are they saying when they come to Moshe Rabbeinu? What they're saying is that there may not be any sons in this family, but if there are no sons, our family still counts. Now, I want you to understand very carefully. We'll talk more about the daughters of Tzolof'chad when we get there. They were not feminists. They understood full well that if there would be brothers, they would not inherit. And they were not complaining about that. They understood. If there are boys, the boys get. We don't. We get that. That's not what they were complaining about. But they were saying, if we have no brothers, our family still counts. Our family still matters. We're not irrelevant as a family. The line of our father, Tzolof'chad, matters. Just like he mattered, we matter. And therefore, they said, we should get land in the land of Israel. Their argument, when we get there, you will see, their argument is going to be, either we count and we get land, or if we don't count, then our mother should be considered like someone who is childless, and she should marry her brother-in-law. There should be yibum. There should be a levirate marriage, because she should be like a woman whose husband died without children. And she should therefore have to have yibum from the brother. Do we count or do we not count? That was their argument. It was a wise argument. That's part of the way we know how wise they were, that they understood they can ask a question pitting two sides against themselves, which is a very clever way of asking the question. As we'll see, we'll talk about it more when we get there. So their point was, this family matters. And that was the point that their father, Tzolof'chad, was making as well, that this generation matters, even though, unfortunately, they were denied going into Eretz Yisrael because of their actions. and that would successfully line up Tzalafchad with his daughters. It is still wrong. He still should not have done it. It was still an Avera. Hashem doesn't want Averas being done. And it is a sad story. But the apples here still didn't fall far from the tree. It's still the righteous daughters do come from a person who is demonstrating a sensitivity and a mission that he's trying to get across.
Also, then he showed that his value, his life had value, not only in that while his actions are, he's responsible for his actions, but also his death, because of his death, he got this little message of Shemira Shabbos and what happens if you're not.
Yeah, it does, right? He is now the example for us. Again, it doesn't justify, it is important to know, it does not justify, the end does not justify the means. He should not have done it. But there is good that comes out of it in what you're saying, that we do see what happens with violating Shabbos. It is.
Why did B'nos Lefkad have to say, our father died because of his sin?
Okay, so let's wait for that. You're right, it's a good question. Why do they need that preamble? We're going to talk about that when we get to Darzus Lefkad.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.